Chapter 1. The stranger didn't shatter Adam's world all at once. That was what Adam Price would tell himself later, but that was a lie. Adam somehow knew right away, right from the very first sentence, that the life he had known as a content, suburban, married father of two was gone forever. It was a simple sentence on the face of it, but there was something in the tone, something knowing and even caring that let Adam know that nothing would ever be the same. You didn't have to stay with her, the stranger said.
That's Harlan Coben reading the beginning of his thriller, The Stranger.
I'm all about suspense, trying to make you turn that next page. I want you to start The Stranger at 11 o'clock at night, think, I'll read 10 or 15 minutes, and the next thing you know, it's 4 in the morning. That's the kind of book I try to write.
And it's worked out pretty well for him.
The Stranger is my 27th book, and I'm told worldwide I'm around 70 million books in print.
So presumably you know what you're doing. So let me ask you this. Any rules of thumb for optimal creation of suspense and surprise?
For me, I usually, and I used to say always, but in one or two books I haven't, I know the ending. I know that final twist and surprise. So I compare it, like if you're traveling someplace, if I'm traveling from New Jersey to Los Angeles, I can go off-road. I mean, and I always do in the books. I can go via the Suez Canal or I can stop in Tokyo, but I'll always end up in L.A. Because I can see L.A. I know L.A. is the ending, and thus I can move in a way that can surprise you because I know I can get back on that road. So that's kind of one of the things. If you know where your last destination is, I can lead you astray in a lot of different ways and still, at least myself, keep my eye on the prize. Mm-hmm. I really do want to fool you in the end. I don't really like to do it through manipulation, but I can do it in an interesting misdirection. Also, the other way is to play with what you've normally seen. Play with your normal perception. So there's a lot of times when you're reading one of my books, I hope, where you're going, I know where he's going with this. I'll play with that, knowing that you're going to think that, and then smack you in the back of the head.
Coben has come to the conclusion that a corpse, while perfectly useful for creating suspense, is not necessarily as useful as a missing person.
I often have missing people in my books, and a missing component is really interesting. In the case of a missing person versus a murder, if a person's dead, they're dead, I'm just trying to solve the crime. But if a person is missing, you have hope. And hope can be the cruelest thing in the world. It can crush your heart like an eggshell, or it can make it soar. And so you raise the stakes by giving people hope, and you raise the stakes by just leaving something out that maybe can complete you.
Tell me this, dear listener. Have we raised your hopes? Are we going to crush your heart like an eggshell? Or make it soar? And what are we leaving out?
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We were talking with the novelist Harlan Coben about how he creates suspense on the page. And what, you may be asking yourself, can this possibly have to do with economics? Good question.
I'm Jeff Ely, professor of economics at Northwestern University.
Okay.
Alex Frankel, assistant professor of economics at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago.
Okay, cool. And Emir?
I'm Emir Kamenitsa. I'm professor of economics at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago.
So, gentlemen, I hold in my hands a 2015 issue of the Journal of Political Economy, or the JPE, as economists call it. It's one of the most highly regarded economics journals in the land. And this particular issue features a paper by the three of you called Suspense and Surprise. So, to the layperson, to me, what's a paper like that doing in a journal like this?
So in a nutshell, it's an economics paper because
And let me
it's
say,
about...
I say that with all admiration, I hope you know.
And the admiration was noted.
Okay.
we view the construction and the development of suspense and surprise and other aspects of entertainment as basically optimally economizing on a scarce resource, which is the ability to change someone's beliefs.
There's lots of settings where someone that's about to engage in economic transaction cares about what the other person thinks. A salesperson wants you to think that they like your car. A lobbyist wants a politician to think that this policy that's good for the industry is good for them. So the whole idea of how do you change people's beliefs has lots and lots of economic applications.
Okay, so if you want to think about how to optimize suspense and surprise, the first thing you want to do is distinguish between the two, right? Here again is Harlan Coben.
Well, suspense is, to me, keeping people engaged and gripped and turning the pages. Someone could put a gun against your head and you still want to read. That's suspense. Surprise is when you reach that ending or when you reach certain points in a book and you almost gasp out loud because the book took you in a place you didn't expect to go.
The three economists offer a bit more formal definition of suspense and surprise. They both revolve around our existing beliefs. Here's Kamenitsa.
If you have, say, two outcomes, a belief is just a number between 0 and 1 that indicates the probability that describes your views at that moment, how likely a particular outcome is.
Suspense has to do with our beliefs before an event happens, surprise afterward.
A moment has suspense if my belief in the next period is a very volatile thing. I don't quite know what I'm going to think in the next period.
So suspense is the anticipation that your beliefs will change. With a surprise, your beliefs have already changed. A lot, if it's a big surprise. Alex Frankel gives the example of watching a baseball game.
And it's full count, bases loaded, two outs. Something is going to happen at the next pitch that's going to change your beliefs about how the game will proceed going forward. So that's the moment when you're really on the edge of your seat, you're excited. So suspense, in a more formal way, looks at a measure of how much are your beliefs at the next period, your beliefs in one moment, likely to be different from your beliefs today. That captures how much information is about to be revealed. On the other side, surprise is trying to capture the excitement you get after something big just happens. Your beliefs just changed, whether or not you expected them to change. There's a home run, your team is now more likely to win, you're excited, you're celebrating.
I don't know exactly how to ask this question. I don't think I want to say which sports are the best necessarily for suspense and surprise, although that is kind of what I really want to know.
So if you compare soccer in particular to lots of sports which are popular in the United States, one thing you find is that soccer scores very low based on the data we collected in terms of the amount of surprises that it generates. But it does score very high on suspense. So even that observation alone might change the conversation from which sport is boring. Boring kind of suggests a certain unidimensional measure of excitement. And partly what we're doing is emphasizing a two-dimensional measure of excitement. So maybe by boring you mean, well, quite often nothing surprising happens. Yes, that's true. But there's very few times in soccer where you really can safely get up and leave for 5 minutes and come back knowing you didn't really miss anything dramatic, which you can quite often do in basketball and baseball simply because nothing dramatic could possibly happen over the next 5 minutes.
Knowing what you've learned from analyzing surprise and suspense in sport, if the three of you could come up with a brand new sport that would be extraordinarily fulfilling for the maximum number of people, what would that sport be?
So going back to the idea that excitement is two-dimensional, we don't necessarily want to give one answer, but we can talk about how we would maximize suspense, how we would maximize surprise separately. So let's do that. As we said, soccer is very suspenseful, at any moment something very big could happen. The sport we would propose, to be even more suspenseful than soccer, has even fewer goals, but goals are bigger. And so how do we get that? Well, in soccer, any goal you score can only get you from being behind to being tied, or being tied to being ahead. So it can't move beliefs by all that much. And then if someone is two goals ahead, the next score doesn't change your beliefs much at all. So here's the game we propose. The last team to score wins. Now, at any moment you blink, you could miss the game-winning goal. And of course, the rules have to be changed a lot to accommodate this. When you're ahead, you only play defense, you're no longer trying to score, and so forth. But that would be a very suspenseful game.
The two things to add to what Alex said is, for his specific proposal, what we'd want to do also is to have goals shrink over time so that scoring becomes less likely.
You mean the physical goal shrinks over time?
The physical goal shrinks over time. And you can imagine when the two posts touch each other, that's when the game's over. Mm-hmm. But the other thing to add is that really this is an answer within a particular context of a sport. It is a tweak rather than design. Your question was about a design. The reason why the design is difficult is that almost every setting that is that provides entertainment has a lot of sort of cultural elements that are part of it that make it actually the game that it is. Okay, you can't change the game so much so that it stops resembling the actual thing that people recognize as a game. There's a lot of elements that are complementary to the provision of information, like particular kind of athleticism or particular sort of traditions or so on. And those are absolutely integral to people's engagement and just investment in the outcomes. And that's why it'd be really hard to design a sport from scratch, because you'd have to build this whole mythology around it as well.
Well, what about Quidditch?
Sir, it's Quidditch tomorrow.
Then I suggest you take extra care, Mr. Potter.
That seems like it was a pretty great design of a brand new sport slash game that had all kinds of suspense and surprise and even high stakes.
We have a proof that Quidditch can't be optimal, don't we?
So every time someone has tried to explain the rules of Quidditch to me, I have not read the Harry Potter books, I should say.
Oh, well, that's got to be step one. I mean,
they have tried to explain the rules, and they get into these small details about people chasing a snitch.
The golden snitch.
I like this ball.
There are complicated rules, and then in the end, it sounds like, and all of that stuff that happened in the first, you know, 9/10 of the game doesn't matter at all, because then someone, what is it? They catch the snitch.
Harry Potter has caught the snitch.
And then the game is over and they win.
Gryffindor wins.
Well, if we want to venture off a little bit into game theory, there's actually some interesting strategy associated with catching the snitch, because the rules are that the game ends. But if you're behind, of course, you don't want the game to end. So it's a really interesting theoretical question from a game theory point of view of what do you do when you found the snitch and you're behind? You actually have to make sure that the other guy doesn't know that you found the snitch. And so you have to fly in completely random directions in order that your path of flight doesn't reveal any information about the location of the snitch. And that might be a pretty interesting task to do, even if you were on a broom.
Okay, so first of all, you may be thinking, wow, economists are such killjoys. How can you turn something as fun as sports into a sack of math? Now, if it's any comfort, they can also take the fun out of non-sporting events, too. Alex Frankel here.
So one thing that I think is interesting about just the realms of movies or novels relative to sports is that in sports, the rules are all known very well. Reading a book, it's a lot harder to know what you should believe. Or watching a movie, these things are going to depend on just what are the formulas of the genre? How likely do you think plot twists are? It's not going to be determined by the rules of the game in the way that sports are.
Harlan Coben agrees with this point. And he says that from the novelist's perspective, this is harder than you might think.
my world has to actually be more realistic than the real world. I mean, you know, I remember a few years ago there was that horrible case of the girl Elizabeth Smart, who was kidnapped when she was, I think, 15 or 16. And if I wrote that in a book, I mean, it ended up being a homeless guy who had done work in their house. If I had written that as a book and you said, wait a minute, no cops looked at the homeless guy, the crazy homeless guy with the God complex who was working in her, you would throw the book across the room because it's completely unrealistic.
The economists, being economists, have of course thought about this numerically. In, let's say, a mystery novel, what is the ultimate number of plot twists?
3 on average.
The number is not in our paper.
The number is not in your paper, but you've written it elsewhere, yes?
Yes. You wanted a short answer. So the short answer really is 3 on average. The slightly longer answer is, you know, it depends on the preferences. You could imagine someone who really likes, you know, to have lots of tiny little surprises, and someone who, but you know, according to you know, reasonable parameters, the number is small and probably around 3.
Their reasoning is pretty simple if you think about a given person's capacity for surprise as a scarce resource. Too few plot twists and you bore the reader or viewer. Too many and you overwhelm them. I put their premise to Harlan Coben. Do you think about it that way? Do you think about this arsenal of, you know, this pool of surprise and suspense that you have to have enough of to pay off, but if you do too much, then it's not good?
Yeah, it's a tough balance all the time. I try to, the key, I think, is to try to make it organic. I sometimes, if I am guilty, I go too far. I rarely met a twist I didn't like. In fact, I'm doing this TV show in France right now, and I had this ridiculous twist at the very, very end that changes the whole thing. And I loved it. It was such a great twist, but as I'm watching, I'm like, the only problem is you forget the wonderful emotion you felt the scene before. So as much as it pains me, I'm going to get rid of that last twist. One of the hardest part of the job is to make sure at the ending, because I don't just want to surprise you, I need to move you emotionally with the ending. So it's one thing to stir or fool the mind and the pulse, but I also have to stir the heart. Mm-hmm. And that's the hardest part of my job. That's the part that really freezes me sometimes.
Okay, so, every creator wants to get the bang out of the surprise that he creates.
That's Jeff Ely.
And he doesn't internalize the fact that if he creates yet another surprise, that's going to prime the audience to expect yet another surprise the next time he watches some other guy's movie. And so if all of the filmmakers could get together and collude, they would agree to have fewer surprises in order to make each surprise more valuable and make everything more suspenseful. But each guy is self-interested, and so he's producing too much of it.
So we're advocating for the consolidation of the media industry.
It explains why, Alex and I, before coming in here, we were talking about superhero fights. And, you know, every single time that the superheroes that get into a fight are going to knock each other out, but they're going to come right back up. And there's really absolutely no surprise whatsoever involved in watching superheroes fight. And, you know, that's because at some point in time, you know, superheroes were new, and the guy who was first controlling the superheroes took advantage of the fact that people weren't experienced with them, and they got all of the surprises out of the way. And now we're sort of stuck with, you know, the legacy of that, which is that genre at least has been completely tapped out in terms of the excitement.
Or if you think of a writer writing something about a sporting event. So you're watching Friday Night Lights about a football match. You can guess there's probably going to be, you know, they're going to be down by 3 touchdowns, and then they're going to have some epic run at the end where they tie it up and then win at the last second. This is something that's very unlikely to happen in an actual football game, and probably extremely likely to happen in a TV show about a football game. They're taking advantage of our beliefs from one frame and then just adding too many surprises, kind of exploiting it in the other.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, we hear from Brian Grazer, one of the producers of Friday Night Lights, along with many other huge hits.
I can tell you how we created suspense if you want.
And what happens when a filmmaker fails to heed the laws of surprise and suspense?
Either, you know, you're just going to have to live with that and the declining box office receipts that come as a result, or, you know, you have to find a new genre.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
What you're about to hear is not a surprise. I ruined the surprise by telling you right before the break who we'd be talking to. But hey, maybe you have a bad memory.
Hi, I'm Brian Grazer. Happy to be here with you today on Freakonomics. Currently, I produce a TV series called Empire, which is rather exciting.
We know what
volcanic.
It is. We know what
All
it
right.
is.
That's
okay. a gigantic show.
And then
okay.
24, Arrested Development, Friday Night Lights, and so a few shows like that. And then, of course, some movies. I won an Oscar for A Beautiful Mind, and I produced Apollo 13, American Gangster, which I love, 8 Mile, Friday Night Lights, Rush, probably many more I'm forgetting right now.
A Beautiful Mind is the film about John Nash, the Princeton mathematician who dealt for many years with paranoid schizophrenia. In 1994, he was awarded a Nobel Prize for his contributions to economics and game theory. In May of 2015, he was killed in a traffic crash at age 86, along with his wife. I interviewed Brian Grazer shortly before Nash died, but his admiration was obvious. For starters, there's the title that Grazer has given the book he recently wrote, A Curious Mind. Grazer writes about his habit of arranging conversations with people he admires, curiosity conversations, he calls them.
So I've done that with probably 1,000 people, and the book itself is in some ways a synthesis of these over 30 years of meetings that I had. It's really, what I found is that each person, each subject became kind of a dot in a larger constellation. And in some ways, at some times, they became insights that gave me an interesting or new perspective on what could be a movie or television.
All right. So, Brian, let's talk about, I want to talk about suspense and surprise. And the premise here is that these three economists have written a paper that analyzes wow. how to optimize surprise and suspense. Okay,
oh
so
my God, that's brilliant.
You know, they talk
you
about
know, our the best... show Empire operates on that axiom.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when people say why did, I mean, nobody knows why a success really works because there's no exact formula. So in the case of Empire, we're asked quite a bit, like, why is it so successful? Or isn't that amazing? And what's the formula? And every week it's gone up and up and up. Well, the one consistent thing is that we create surprises or shocking moments every single week, really shocking moments that are about betrayal.
I'd never let anything come between friendship, except a bullet.
Or cheating, or greed, envy, you know, wanting the throne, but willing to do anything to get the throne. Who's sleeping with who? Oh my God, is that really, I can't believe Cookie really did that.
What if I were to disclose to the SEC that I was the original investor with $400,000 in drug money?
So that is like within its entire formula is the one thing that I think is the driving force of why people so dig the show.
Now, let me ask you this. How formulaic is that? I don't mean formulaic here as a pejorative, but I mean when the scripts are being written, then developed and rewritten, and then finally shot, I mean, because these guys will, what they've done is analyzed a bunch of what they feel are successful pieces of work, whether it's film, novels, sporting events, and so on. And they've come down to like the optimal number of plot twists, which by the way is 3, and the best pace at which to release or suspend information, how to anticipate and maybe upend the audience's expectations. So how formulaic is that for you, whether with Empire or with other TV shows or films you've made?
It's actually not formulaic in the way you're stating it. It's not consciously formulaic. Now, I know when horror films are made, they do adhere to a formula like the one you just mentioned. But in our show, it's a much more rough edge than that. It's because we have other elements that are, we have music, we have external music, internal music, the characters singing. So it might find a formula or an algorithm at some point, given that we've only done one season. But currently, we just know that we want at least 3 of those situations, shocking or surprising moments
per episode. Right. So at least you agree with them on the number.
But it's not within the formula that I think you're it's not that precise yet.
So when I was looking at all the films that you've been involved in TV shows and thinking about surprise and suspense, one that came to mind again and again and I want to talk to you about is Apollo 13. So I don't know if you'll agree that with me that that is innately suspenseful.
Yeah, it's very suspenseful.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we have a problem.
It was the goal to make it suspenseful, and it was hard to do because...
That's what I was thinking. It's because we know what happens at the end.
Exactly. We know what happens in the end, which is the most important factor. And secondarily, we're limited to only a couple of worlds, and mostly it was the world of the space capsule.
Exactly. So, like, all the suspense is like...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty inactive. I mean, considering it's a space mission, a lot of the shots are, instrument panels and more instrument panels and the switch being switched, and then we get to
Kimball
see some
lock
sweat.
And, yeah. Yeah.
And yet, it's unbelievably suspenseful, even though I assume, I don't know if you had any data on how many people actually knew that they all got back okay. Did you know anything about what the audience was expecting on that front?
No, we didn't. We didn't know. We assumed it was a pretty high number, though. I mean, because you're going to market the movie. It's going to, marketing brings attention to it. People say, what's it about? And they say, these guys that tried to get to the moon, I guess they're saying, and made it back. You know what I mean? So once it got on people's minds, I think it was a pretty high percent thought it was, they made it back safely. I can tell you how we created suspense if you want.
Tell me. That's why we're here. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, we created suspense by living inside the psyche of these guys, these astronauts, spending a little more time than people are comfortable showing their lives and their lives with their families and people that are really important to them. So once they got on that rocket and that engine is blowing them up off into outer space... You're cutting to their families all the time. In fact, that one girl at Cape Canaveral is crying and she sees her husband go up. It gets you really emotional. And so every time there was a worry in outer space, you'd cut to mission control trying to solve the problem. And then when the problem couldn't be solved, you often are cutting to the family or the priest or... people in the external world that are really, really important to those 3 astronauts in their lives, the kids in school.
Yeah. When you're on the set, what's it like to watch scenes being shot that will end up as very suspenseful, but I assume that in the actual shooting, there's nothing remotely suspenseful about it at all?
Well, it's boring. I mean, you know what I mean? It's not... you're asking, they're just pieces of things. So when you're trying to create suspense, you're getting little pieces of things. You're not shooting full sequences. And in fact, when we were shooting everything in the rocket, because we decided to show zero gravity by having zero gravity as opposed to taking the wires off digitally or anything like that, we you know, we had to use this special KC-135 jet that produced parabuluses, meaning weightlessness of about 24 to 28 seconds, and you'd get about 16 seconds of screen time per parabulus. So you had to build those minutes tiny brick by tiny brick the entire time.
What's it like to watch the finished product when you know how it was assembled? Does the suspense and surprise work on you? I know you were invited to show Apollo 13 at the White House by President Clinton, and by then I know you'd seen the film at least a few times. But even by that point, this was still a little bit before the release, does the suspense still work on you by that point, or is it more like you're kind of looking for the rivets?
Yeah. On that movie, the suspense does still work for me. And the more than the suspense, the emotion is. And that when that rocket takes off and you hear that James Horner music and that rocket's launch was storyboarded by James Cameron, and it's like the sum total of what the entire Apollo program felt like to me and what its place in the world was, you know, like the enormity of the program in relation to geopolitical politics. And I just it's just so powerful and human. So I'm moved by it every time.
We have liftoff.
Brian Grazer has been phenomenally successful as a producer. In 1986, he co-founded Imagine Entertainment along with Ron Howard. Including the projects they've made together, Grazer's movies have taken in more than $13 billion with 43 Oscar nominations. His TV shows have been nominated for more than 150 Emmys. It is, of course, impossible to attribute Grazer's success to simply understanding how to dish out suspense and surprise, but according to The Economist, you can make somewhat of the counter-argument that if you fail to handle suspense and surprise properly, the market will punish you. Here's Jeff Ely.
When I give this talk, I show a plot of the filmmaker, and I can never pronounce his name right. I don't know if you know him. M. Night Shyamalan. And you know, and I'm about to disparage him, but I actually think that The Sixth Sense was a great movie.
I see dead people.
I really liked it. I even liked the second movie, Unbreakable, quite a lot. But when I present this, I show a plot of M. Night Shyamalan's box office numbers for his films, starting with The Sixth Sense.
And that plot shows a clear downward trend since The Sixth Sense.
And, you know, this is an example of why once you've lost control of the audience's expectations by exploiting their naivete the first time around. Once you've exploited the audience the first time, they're coming to expect it. And either, you know, you're just going to have to live with that and the declining box office receipts that come as a result, or, you know, you have to find a new genre, or, you know, and you have to reset the audience's expectations in some way. And apparently he failed to do that.
As Harlan Coben said about writing thrillers, you're not just creating suspense and surprise on their own. You're creating them in relation to the consumer's expectations, which are constantly being upgraded. Coming up next on Freakonomics Radio, in the business world, why do so many firms operate on gut instinct instead of using the data?
I never would have thought this before I started working with companies. I never would have imagined that it is an IT problem.
And a question from a listener that my Freakonomics co-author Steve Levitt finds downright inspiring.
I do love Glenn's question. I think this is super smart and really interesting and important. I think it's great.
And if you want to hear more Freakonomics Radio, check out our website at freakonomics.com, where you can find the podcast, our books, a blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio with your host, Stephen Dubner.
Hey, Dubner.
Hey, Levi, how's it going?
It's going good.
So are you feeling recovered from book tour yet?
Yes.
I thought it was interesting. As much as you whined and complained about how much you hate the book tour, it actually worked out beautifully, didn't it? Do you want to tell people how beautifully that worked out?
Oh, so everywhere we went, people were very gentle with me. They gave me presents. Thank you very much for the coffee, and thank you very much for the In-N-Out Burger gift certificate that I used.
Bacon. There were plates of bacon on stage with us when we gave talks.
And poor Dubner took the brunt of it. Everybody slapped you around and let me do my thing. Mm. It couldn't have been better.
I'm like, oh, Steve Levitt, thank you so much for coming to San Francisco. I know you don't like to leave your room. That was a great piece of game theory, because you have no problem getting out there. You like to talk to people. You say you don't.
No, I like to be in my room.
Yeah, you say you do.
I only like to be in my room.
Now, what would you say would be a highlight of the book tour, or a low light? Could be either.
Let me think. The other day, a stranger rolled down his window of his car and yelled to me, "Hey, I love the Tipping Podcast." That's bad. That's when we got to retire. When strangers are rolling down their window and knowing who we are, that's when we got to be careful.
Steve Levitt, my Freakonomics friend and co-author, is an economist at the University of Chicago. Whenever we publish a new book, our publisher sends us out on a book tour, which Levitt pretends to hate. But honestly, it's a blast. True, it's long days, lots of travel, but come on. Big auditoriums full of people willing to sit and listen to what you have to say? Not bad. You want to know the most surprising thing? We started asking the audience how many of them regularly listen to Freakonomics Radio. And about 90% of the hands went up, whether we were in New York or California or in the UK. It was amazing. Although it did make me wonder, if it weren't for Freakonomics Radio, if our book tour would happen in much smaller auditoriums. Thanks to everyone who comes out to those events, thanks for listening to this program, and thanks also for sending in your questions. Shortly after publishing our third book, Think Like a Freak, we asked you to ask us anything you wanted to know about what we'd written. So, in this next segment, we'll answer some of those questions. So, Levitt, let's start with Andrea Kate Crary from Fargo, North Dakota. Andrea writes, "You asserted the most important idea in your new book was the underlying principle that to think like a freak, you must in fact think. I heartily agree with you on the importance of thinking and wonder if you have any suggestions on how. It seems to me that my brain defaults to autopilot. Is there a way to reset my brain's default position?" Lev, what do you say to Andrea?
I would say to Andrea that I think autopilot is indeed the right default for the brain, because the world's too complicated and there's too many things to do to try and really think your way around everything. What I would suggest Andrea try to do is, at certain moments when it seems like the marginal benefit of thinking is high, she should see if she can switch her brain into a thinking mode and then kick in the thinking when it really will be to your advantage. And so, for instance, part of thinking, I think, is just finding the quiet time to do it. And so maybe a place to start would be when you see problems or questions that you think might use thinking, file them away in your brain. And when you have quiet time, when you're doing laundry or you're trying to rock a baby to sleep or something like that, then take those moments to actually go back and try to engage your brain and just do it a little bit at a time and see if anything good comes out. I mean, good ideas are hard to come by. I mean, Dubner and I spend a lot of time thinking, and we're lucky if we have one or two good ideas a year. So I think the expectations shouldn't be too high.
Yeah, I would also say to Andrea that it's a great idea to just work hard to spend time with people that aren't a lot like you, whether it's, you know, vocationally or age-wise or politically, religiously, geographically, whatever. Because it's amazing how simply doing that will change or broaden, you know, give you an angle on a problem that you wouldn't have considered otherwise. And that, you know, the more we look at the way that people kind of group around groupthink and herd mentality, one reason it's hard to come up with a good solution to a problem is because you're just hearing, you know, this kind of siloed echo chamber of everybody else that you hang out with. So if you can seek out people who look at things really differently from you, whether you're an artist and you don't hang out with data people or politically left and don't talk to people on the right, et cetera, I think that's a way to get a leg up. Levitt, Michael Carley, who is Associate Director of the Institutional Research and Reporting something at Kern Community College in Bakersfield, California, writes to say this: I work as an educational researcher. How would we, in hiring employees for our department, find those with the humility to say when they don't know the answer to a question? A lot of time is wasted when employees plod along in ignorance rather than admitting limitations. Levitt, you have some kind of good trick for employers to screen for that ability?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is, in the course of the interview, what most people do is fake their way. There's a general sense, and it came up on the book tour three or four times when people said, well, if I say I don't know, I will never get the job.
And you're sympathetic to that issue, yeah?
I do think that actually it probably is true. If the people who are hiring you are of the mind that you should never, ever say, I don't know, and they themselves never, ever say, I don't know, then saying, I don't know, is not a great idea before you get the job. Now, once you have the job, you have a little more time and leeway to try and change people's views and to show people that when you say, I don't know, and then you go back to the data and you figure out the answer and you come back a week later or an hour later or a month later and say, I now know, that people will be impressed and will come to respect you more. But you don't get that second chance. You don't get the week or the month if you're doing the interview. But clearly, if you want to attract people who will say, I don't know, the interview process is the right way to do it, or even before that, in some sort of an online application, to ask the kinds of questions which will elicit different answers from people who are liars and fakers and people who aren't. I mean, the example we give in the beginning of the chapter on I don't know is about children, and they're asked in a psychology study to respond to questions which they simply can't answer given the amount of
patently unanswerable questions, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so one could imagine asking completely unanswerable questions in an interview and seeing how people respond.
Hey, let me ask you this. What about combining two ideas that we've talked about in the past, unanswerable questions and the need to say I don't know, and kind of this burning desire to make predictions about any and everything? What about that? What about asking potential employees to make predictions, which you could kill two birds in one stone? You could see how willing they are to admit they don't know, and you could see how they feel about this relatively impossible task generally of predicting the future.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
What's the question you write? What do you ask them to predict?
I would say what the interviewer is going to have for lunch that day. Because it's completely stupid and pointless.
And totally unanswerable.
And completely unanswerable.
Although you could say, well, you look like a pretty chubby fellow, so I'm going to say you're going to have some pasta.
But I think it's the kind of reaction someone would have to that question. It's so nonsensical that it's a signal to anyone who has common sense that you can't possibly expect a serious response to it. Because I think that it will pick up on other things too, which is just common sense and ability to understand how humanity works. If you ask some question about what do you think our revenues will be in the year whatever, then it actually sounds like you could make a prediction.
Well, it's an invitation to fake it too, whereas this one is right. It's giving you the option to take the high road.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that interviewers always do, and I don't know if this works at all or not, would be to say, so could you tell me about a time in your career in which you have been faced with a question you didn't know the answer to, and you simply said, I don't know, and how did it turn out? I mean, that would be the more traditional way to do it. Maybe you could do both.
Levitt, Mikhail Marchenko from Lenexa, Kansas, I believe, writes to say, in your book, you use a metaphor, a football player, meaning soccer player, who is faced with a tough decision that can have a lasting impact on his professional career, the penalty kick. So Mikhail goes on to say, you write that humans are motivated by myriad things, chief among which is pride and reputation. As you simply yet so elegantly, thank you very much, put it, none of us want to look stupid. So this is about the difference between acting in your own interest versus acting in the public interest, to shorthand it a lot. Now, Mikhail asks, has there ever been a society that strongly believed in the greater good of the community and which punished those who went against the grain and acted to benefit themselves instead? So, Levitt, I have to say, my first thought was, well, that sounds a little bit like the former Soviet Union, which by the sound of his name, Mikhail Marchenko, this listener probably is a little bit familiar with. I mean, it's interesting to me that he didn't bring it up. It also brings to mind, for me, a lot of religious communities, you know, ultra-Orthodox Jews, even in 21st century America, and a lot of the Anabaptist communities like the Amish and Bruderhof and Mennonite. But Levitt, I'm really curious to know if you know anything about this societies that kind of, you know, reward the communal, punish the individual goal-seeking, and whether, yeah, that's all.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that was one of the premises of communism and socialism, was to put the collective above the individual. But the problem with those systems is that it's very hard to incentivize individuals when the benefits go to others. I mean, really, if you think about it, corporations have a little bit of the same flavor, that in many corporations, the financial incentives of individuals are not that strong. So the difference in the profit that accrues to the company can be 50 times, 100 times my own private benefit of the actions I take. And then it's hard to incentivize people. I mean, maybe the ultimate society that has managed to succeed in putting the collective above the individual are things like ants and termites, right? Because, I mean, that's exactly what happens in these colonies. It's because the ants don't have enough brains to do anything different. But, I mean, bees sting and die because of it, but they're programmed to act on behalf of the community.
Since you brought us to corporations and corporate behavior, let's go to, here's a related question from someone named Tracy Lum, who writes to say, and by the way, every person, so the minute you hear your name on this program, that means that you are going to get some Think Like a Freak swag. So you should be very happy about that, not just for the pride, but for the avarice part of the mention. Mm-hmm. So Tracy Lum writes to say, you write that one of the reasons that people ignore data in favor of gut instinct is tradition and resistance to change. In an ever-changing, competitive, mostly capitalist economy, I'm wondering how and why these types of organizations and individuals survive. So that's really what you're talking about, Levitt, to some degree, which is that in companies, corporations, the boss has different set of incentives, perhaps, than almost everybody else. So tell us about that. You've been spending a lot of time in corporations consulting with them. Do you, A, see a resistance to data generally? And if so, do you see it higher or lower down the ladder? And do you think that there is a split between the incentives for the people in the corner office and the people on the ground?
So that's a great question. And I might challenge the premise. The premise of the question is that these old organizations that are resistant to data will survive or are surviving. But in fact, they're certainly not thriving. And what I see all the time is the incredible difficulty that companies, and really people, because companies are made up of people, have in adapting to new situations. And it's really amazing. If you look back at what the 50 biggest companies were in the world 100 years ago, I mean, very few of them exist. I mean, other people looked at this. I haven't looked at detail, but companies have very short lifespans relative to, say, universities. The same universities that were the most highly ranked 100 years ago are still almost without exception. Maybe Stanford has gotten better in the U.S. But in general, universities all stick around and companies don't. And I think it's because the university environment doesn't change very much, but the corporate environment, what consumers want and what producers make, changes a lot. And it's hard for companies to keep up. What I really believe, though, is that the importance of data and the value of data has gotten so much greater, and the ability to do experiments, that the new wave of companies like Amazon that do experimentation, are just going to devastate the old way of doing things. And the world is changing. It's not just because of data and not just because of experimentation, but there happens to be a correlation between the kinds of companies that are new and innovative and their use of data. And it's absolutely transforming the landscape.
So that being the case, let me just go back to Tracy's question, which you didn't quite get to, you didn't quite answer, which is why are, okay, let's say you're one of these non-transformative, hyper-traditional firms, and you're presumably not an idiot, and you see that firms that don't adapt will suffer, and that part of adapting is to let go, you know, not rely necessarily on gut instinct that's informed by tradition. Why is it so hard for leadership to change? That's really the question that Tracy's asking.
Yeah, I think the hardest single thing is, even if you have the desire, which you may or may not have, to be data-driven, that the existing systems, I never would have thought this before I started working with companies. I never would have imagined that it is an IT problem, that you simply cannot get the data you want, and that the data are held in 27 different data sets that have different identifiers. So you simply, sometimes when my little consulting firm TGG comes into a company, we'll spend something like 3 or 6 person months working with a company of trying to just put together a data set to do a basic analysis that I think many listeners would think, wow, I would think that a big fancy company would be able to do this with the push of a button. But it really is, it's the IT support and the complexity in these big firms blows your mind about how hard it is to do the littlest simple things.
Levitt, let's end with one more question here that I think is a nice ending. Glenn Hall writes to say, I read the chapter about Kobayashi, that's Takeru Kobayashi, and how he smashed the hot dog eating record. I noted your comment about how he didn't think about the previous world record of 25, or else he may have stopped at 28 or 30 instead of making it to 50. We don't say he would have stopped at 28 or 30. He just wouldn't have been able to get so high if he had honored that barrier of 25. So Glenn continues to write, I've been thinking about this for quite some time in regard to a person's chronological age. In the United States, the retirement age has remained at 65 in spite of the large increase in life expectancy. Does this set up an artificial barrier relating to a person's productive life? I am well into middle age, yet the idea of an end game at 65 has never entered my mind. How much of the aging process is physiological and how much is psychological due to culturally induced artificial factors such as the 65-year-old retirement age? I am currently engaged in an experiment trying to, quote, think myself younger, and it seems to be working. That's what Glenn Hall writes. So Levitt, I have to say, I love this question. I love the idea of artificial barriers and ignoring them. And I know you kind of, you're not so keen on that idea yourself, are you?
I'm not as keen as you are, but I do love Glenn's question. I think this is super smart and really interesting and important. I think it's great. And it's probably true. I mean, everything he says is true, that we set up these retirement ages decades ago when people were much less healthy and lived shorter. And I don't know. I do think that it's easy when you're an adult to just get caught in the trap of feeling old and getting afraid of everything. So I think a lot of things are under the control of people. You see it all the time.
The thing that his question makes me think is that, yeah, as you mentioned, longevity has increased so much. I think in the 20th century, life expectancy in the U.S. at birth doubled, which is just an astonishing. I mean, that'll never happen again. I think it's safe to say that'll never happen again. So to me, one of the really interesting—
Wait, good. Can I interrupt you on that,
sure,
though?
Sure, yeah.
The thing, it's not just longevity. It's the state of your body at the time that you're 65. I think we've had at least as big of improvements. And when you were 65 in the old days and you had worked in some kind of horrible factory 12 hours a day, you were completely broken. But now I think people at 65 are great.
And a much smaller share of the population is doing work that's so physically hard,
exactly,
too,
but right. So it's just a comedy. I mean, working the farm,
sure,
I mean,
yeah,
when you had to, like, I mean, it was incredibly brutal work, as you know, having grown up on a farm. So it's as much the increase in longevity as the state of the body and the quality of life you can have at 65. Look, but it's a different question of whether it's just fun to stop working and to then do 100 other things that you couldn't do when you work. That's. I mean, I don't think either of us are saying no retirement is bad. I think it's what Glenn's saying, which is true, is that there's no reason that if you love what you do in your work that you couldn't still do it. My dad's almost 80, and he's still a practicing doctor because he loves it, and he's not sure what he'd do otherwise. And I think that's exactly the right attitude, and my dad still runs 3 to 5 miles a day, and he acts like he's young, and he is young. He seems young, you know, so. I think Glenn should get both a book and a signed T-shirt, whatever we do, for that kind of insightful question. I mean, we didn't give a great answer. I mean, you think his question's better than any answer we could give.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.